The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the last show of the week. It's Friday's The Greg Hughes Show here in Highland Radio. 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 28th of August. Our Friday panel joining us very shortly to discuss some of the big stories. But we also want you involved in the conversation. You can WhatsApp and text on 086 6025000 086 6025000, or give us a call on 07491 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. And you can watch the show. We are on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. You can just get us on your mobile devices or your smart TV or your Fire Stick. And we're on the X platform at Highland Radio. We're not on YouTube, not Facebook, sorry, because Facebook seemed to think a very innocent post about a crematorium was something to do with crypto deception. So they've banned us from their platform for the period of a week whilst we appeal that. Well, we'll get that sorted. Don't worry about that. But we're on YouTube and we are on X.
The Friday panel on The Greg Hughes Show.
Yes, good morning to you, Paddy Rooney, Chair of Friends of Letterkenny University Hospital. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
It's good to have you back on the show, as always. Councillor Jimmy Brogan, Cathaoirleach of the Donegal Municipal District. Good morning, Jimmy. Good to see you. I'll come to you in a moment. I'll be coming to you in a moment. And Deputy Padraig McLaughlin, Sinn Féin's spokesperson on fisheries and the marine. Good morning to you, Padraig. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Greg. Jimmy, it's usually me that has the thing on mute, so it's nice that somebody else
we have you well trained, Padraig. You haven't made that mistake for a while. Let's start with this one. It broke yesterday evening. Given British Prime Minister Andy Burnham's explicit ruling out of a border poll during his Belfast visit, does a UK Prime Minister taking a border poll off the table respect the provisions of the Good Friday Agreement? Does it undermine the mechanisms for constitutional change in Northern Ireland? Padraig, I'll start with you.
What you see, Andy Burnham yesterday is obviously Andy Burnham supports the concept of the United Kingdom. He's a unionist prime minister. I don't think we've ever had any British prime minister that wasn't unionist. In recent times, we've had very significant assembly elections in Scotland and Wales. And for the first time, we have a first minister in Wales who is pro Welsh independence. It would play Cymru. And in Scotland, obviously the SNP have the first minister. So you have two pro-independence, two nationalist first ministers. And there's no doubt that Andy Burnham had his eye on that. He actually referenced Brexit and the Scottish independence referendum in his comments. And I'm mindful too that he made his comments before he actually met with the political leaders. I know that obviously Mary Lou McDonald and Michelle O'Neill would have made it very clear to him that he has a clear responsibility under the Good Friday Agreement to responsibly prepare the ground and then to call that referendum. And indeed, the SDLP did the same. It was confirmed. So the final point I'll make is this. It doesn't help that we have a Taoiseach. I think the biggest barrier to preparing responsibly for a United Ireland and for a referendum is actually our Taoiseach, Micheál Martin. He clearly, and we heard this from both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael TDs, who wanted to support the Sinn Féin legislation, which was very simple, that you prepare the ground responsibly, that you have a citizens' assembly, you have a green paper, that you, when people go to vote eventually, that they know exactly what it is they're voting for, what kind of health service, education system, and so on. And he even opposed that. So you can't expect the British Prime Minister saying any different when you have a Taoiseach who's even more
vehemently. But regardless of how you would frame Micheál Martin's actions or inaction, and that's how you framed it, he would see it a different way. It's Andy Burnham that made these comments yesterday, but if the truth be told, is there not some advantage to it? We know what triggers a referendum. It would be the majority of people in Northern Ireland likely to want a united Ireland. We're some way off that yet, according to all of the polls. Maybe your party colleagues and those on the other side of the benches need to actually knuckle down and start focusing on running Northern Ireland. And if you remove that question for a while, maybe it will focus minds in that regard.
Well, you can do both. And of course, the biggest problem in the North, as you and I have talked about on numerous occasions is the fact that the budget is controlled by Britain. They control the taxes, they deal with pensions and all the other issues that are there, and they allocate. It's a bit like Donegal County Council. You get allocated a budget and you have to make your best with it. And that's essentially the situation in the north. So
And Donegal County
absolutely.
Council, as its executive, has to work together and campaign central government for extra funding to do extra work. And it's all.
And in fairness, that is happening. I mean, even with DUP and Sinn Féin and all the other parties have major differences, but they're united in that the British government's allocation is absolutely nowhere near what it needs to be to run our public services and run effective services in the north. So all that happens anyway. But we need to prepare responsibly for a united Ireland. It is the referendum is coming. We don't need another Brexit scenario where people are voting for something and then it's utter chaos for 10 years. We had seven British prime ministers now over 10 years. God knows how many British secretary of states. It's total chaos because of the way they dealt with Brexit. So, you know, he referenced Brexit yesterday, Andy Burnham. What he needs to understand is all we're asking for in Ireland is we don't do the same thing, that we prepare responsibly, we take the time to get it right, and then we have the referendum.
All right, Paddy Rooney, what's your view?
Well, Greg, I suppose Andy Burnham would say that, wouldn't he, yesterday, because all of the goodwill, I suppose, that was achieved in recent seems to have dissipated a little bit. I mean, I suppose it's very clear to anybody that the executive in Northern Ireland is not working in any kind of a collegial way at all. I mean, it's very clear that they're not working to any kind of a common purpose. There is a sense that the DUP are trying to block everything that's in any way at all remotely favourable to nationalists. In fact, there are some of the DUP MLAs that I'm talking about, people like Jonathan Buckley and people like Philip Brett and Carla Lockhart outside the executive, you would think that they're in opposition, that they're not in government at all. And of course, Pádraig mentioned about the budget issue, that they're not able to get their head around. Now the Drumcree issue is beginning to bubble. So why do I say all that? It's just things are beginning to ferment up a little bit in Northern Ireland, and this is probably not the right time to be throwing more fuel on the fire there. There is language, all right, in the Good Friday Agreement about the border poll, and both yourself and Pádraig have alluded to it there. And we're probably not at that place yet. I mean, one big deciding factor when we ever come to a poll in Northern Ireland will actually be the attitude of middle-class nationalists in Northern Ireland. And because a lot of people that reside in Northern Ireland work in the hospital here, and I would know them. They're very clear, and they want to know when the time comes, what exactly are they going to be voting for? I mean, there's an assumption here that the vast majority of unionists are going to vote against it anyway. Some of them will vote against it regardless of what's on the table. But it has to be favourable to middle-class nationalists. And I suppose Pádraig is right here. If there's a journey to go on the Northern Ireland poll, having the poll itself is not the place to start, because people need to know, Greg, what they're going to be.
Yes, but in terms of the preparation now and what Pádraig referenced, there's a lot of people are going to want to know, you know, not about, you know, Republican culture or unionism culture in this new united place. I kind of want to know where, if I get cancer, I'm going to get my cancer treatment. I kind of want to know, you know, what's the tax burden on me going to be when all of these civil service jobs go in Northern Ireland? You know, like, I mean, don't get me wrong. There will be obviously an awful lot of people voting in terms of unionism or republicanism. But at the end of the day, too, when it comes down to the vote and Brexit keeps being used, and you can see what happened with Brexit, a lot of people are going to decide, well, what's best for me and my family and my pocket and my health? And how do you even have those conversations in preparation for a border poll from this point?
Well, I mean, that's true. But you know well, Greg, now that the vast majority of loyalists and unionism, particularly that are involved in the Orange Order, the number one issue for them in any elections is the constitutional issue.
But that's 40%. There's 60...
Everything else behind, you know, inflation, unemployment, development, education, they're all secondary to the constitutional issue. And there has to be some groundwork done both inside on Northern Ireland and outside of it. Pádraig is right down here in the Republic, and also Britain will have to join in to try and level that playing field. Because if we ever get to a situation in Northern Ireland and there is a poll, and the result of that poll is a 50% plus one majority in favour of United Ireland, I mean, the way things are at the moment, we'd end up with complete chaos.
Okay, we'll go round again. I just want to bring Jimmy Brogan here, Cathaoirleach of the Donegal Municipal District. What's your views on this, Jimmy?
Yeah, well, I think it's unhelpful that Andy Burnham's just dismissed it, taking it off the table, as he said. Like, at the end of the day, the people of Northern Ireland have the democratic right under the Good Friday Agreement to decide for themselves what they want to do. But, the other guests are both right. There has to be work. The work has to continue. It wasn't probably going to happen in the next year or two anyway. It'll take a lot of preparation, and that's preparation on both sides of the border. Because at the end of the day, if there was a United Ireland and there was a general election in Ireland, we'd be looking at the guts of 7 million people, So we have to prepare for that. Like on the Dáil, I was just looking at it one day there. If you had 7 million people, you'd be looking at 230 to 240 TDs. So there's a lot of preparation to be done before there's a border poll. But I think it's very unhelpful, to just take it off the table, because under the Good Friday Agreement, the people in Northern Ireland have that right to determine their future. So I think just simply dismissing it is the wrong attitude. And I think while it's probably not going to happen in the next couple of years, definitely not going to happen the next couple of years, but I think it's something that you should work towards and keep it on the table, because at the end of the day, people in Northern Ireland are entitled to it, whether Andy Burnham agrees or not.
But I just wonder, and again, I don't really fully get his motivation. It is always on the table because it's contained, within in the Good Friday Agreement. Now, there are other, I mean, it doesn't have to be a majority. There is some provision, I believe, sort of for bringing this forward voluntarily from a British perspective. But he's saying the conversation for now is off the table because the view of the people of Northern Ireland at this point, by all polls, is like 45 odd in favour of the United Kingdom, if I could put it like that, and floating in the mid 30s in terms of United Ireland. So it's not really.
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen that data to prove that the people in Northern Ireland, 40% of them, only 40% of them want a border poll. So. I don't know where he's getting his numbers, but listen, I just think the wording very important as well. To dismiss it like that there, I think before before I think he dismissed it before he'd met with anybody in Northern Ireland. It's the first thing he'd done. So I think it's something that he would he probably should have waited and met people first and then made his decision. But just to fired off a cuff remark like that there was, it's just unhelpful,
Yeah, wasn't off the cuff, a cuff remark, Padraig?
No, not off the cuff.
No, I know. I understand what you mean, but I was going to put more context into the question. Like, really, what I'm saying is do you think there's a political strategy to this, or do you believe Padraig that this is just his views and he's only expressing his views out loud? He's come to Belfast and he's said this. Normally, politicians have a reason for something like that.
Yeah, no, he has his eye on Scotland and Wales. Obviously, Labour have, had a disastrous election, particularly in Wales, where they were the First Minister, and now it's Plaid Cymru, and they lost so much seats. So he clearly has his eye in Scotland and Wales when he made that statement, but it was ill-judged, and he would have met obviously with Sinn Féin and SDLP, who would have been absolutely clear he needs to look back over the Good Friday Agreement. He doesn't get to say anything's off the table. It's down to the people of Ireland. It's north and south that we have the referendum. The people of Ireland will decide. But what we're asking for now, and it couldn't be more sensible, is to prepare responsibly now. That we think the referendum could be 2030. I mean, there'll be a new Fianna Fáil leader early next year. We assume when Micheál Martin is gone from the place as Taoiseach or as Taoiseach, then you have a very different
But
dynamic.
you're, I
Fine
think it's
Gael.
on, is that not an unfair framing of Micheál Martin? I mean, he hosted events around the country discussing United Ireland and what that might look like. I mean, you're not being a bit unfair in how you're framing his position on a United Ireland.
No, and if you talk to Fianna Fáil people privately, they agree with us. They won't say it publicly. I mean, Simon Harris and Fine Gael are about to publish a blueprint on Irish unity. It's going to be published in November. Like Fine Gael used to be behind Fianna Fáil when it came to advocating for a united Ireland. Micheál Martin has been disastrous in that regard, but he'll be gone in the new year. And then you'll have a new leader, whether it's Dara Cleary or Jim O'Callaghan. I would say either of them will be much stronger on a united Ireland. And, that, and then Fine Gael will have a blueprint on Irish unity. And then you're advancing towards making a case jointly to the British government. So it's a very different dynamic when you come into 2027.
All right, last word before we take a break to you, Paddy, if you wish.
Well, you know, I would like to have a border poll, and I would like to have, I would love to see a united Ireland, but I wouldn't like to have a border poll too soon before the groundwork was done and lose it, because if you do that, you're going to put another one back a generation or perhaps two. So, you know, if I was going to have a border poll, I would like to have some sense of that there is a very strong chance that it will succeed.
Would you resist a border poll now, Padraig? Is there provision within the whole arrangement where a party like yours might go, right, you're trying to pull a fast one here, it's like a snap election or something. Would your party welcome a border poll announced for 28 with conversations preparation starting now, or would you resist that?
No, I think that would be wrong. I think you need to prepare responsibly. Like we've talked about a citizens' assembly, an all-island citizens' assembly. We've talked about a green paper. I mean, there's eminent studies already done, but there's a lot more to do. Mm. And Paddy's right. I mean, people need to know what kind of health service it's going to be, education system, taxation system, economy. In fairness, unionists need to know. I would be looking as a, I think younger people from what's called the PUL, the Protestant Unionist Loyalist backgrounds, they are going to be decisive when it comes to this vote. And we need to assure them that everybody's place will be
But all of
protected.
Those, this all, I think really, though, the big swing will be, you know, voters that Paddy's referenced, who I think come from both communities, the Revolting Alliance or whatever they might be, and a huge population of people that have moved to Northern Ireland as well. The demographics have changed significantly. Caller says, not a chance of seeing United Ireland. The people in Northern Ireland are better off. Cars are half the price. The healthcare system is better. The Irish government can't even run this country properly, never mind the extra six counties along with it. To give an example, my sister lives in the north and bought a car for £12,000. The same car cost around €24,000 in the Republic. But there are other things we could compare as well. And a lot of the texts coming in so far, I think, a bit frustrated with politics in general, which kind of supersedes in their minds the conversation we're having. I'll get to those in a moment. My understanding is that in Ireland, the National Centre for Pharmacoeconomics uses a general threshold of €45,000 per quality adjusted life year to judge whether a new drug is cost effective. When a life-saving or life-changing drug is scientifically proven to work, how strictly should the HSC stick to its financial threshold? And at what point does using cold mathematical cost-benefit analysis to deny or delay treatment cross from responsible budget management into a human rights issue? And just to say as we head into this, you know, we had a very high-profile case here in Donegal where a campaign was successful. There was another campaign successful during the week. But there are dozens and dozens of other drugs that aren't available, and they just haven't got the momentum behind them to get them out there into the public sphere and to get a public debate going. Paddy, I mean, obviously you've got a health background, so I'll start with you in relation to this. What's your view?
Well, it is a very a complex issue, I suppose, because most of these high-tech drugs, as they're called, when they come on the marketplace, there's only a small number of people as a percentage of the population that will benefit from them. I happened to, by chance, come across a podcast in the Irish Times a few days ago there, chaired by journalist Pat Leahy, and a panel, and there was two things that they were under discussion on that programme. One was about the young fellas that were killed in the N9 in Dublin, and the other thing was about this particular issue. And the panel come to the conclusion anyway that what happened here was a sort of a microcosm of how we do politics and how we do policies in this country. It shows up very clearly, I suppose, the complete power imbalance between pharmaceutical companies and the Department of Health. And one of the things that they had a great, and I didn't even know this until I heard this, but we're a member of the European Union, but the European Union collectively does not negotiate with pharmaceutical companies. Each country does it on an individual basis. And when they sign an agreement, then or come to an agreement in relation to price, they have some kind of an NDA and a non-disclosure agreement in place. So Portugal are after doing this with this pharmaceutical company, but the Department of Health don't know what kind of a deal that they got. And I suppose the pharmaceutical companies know what government are going to do in this country for the simple reason that all they have to do is look at about what has taken place predominantly over the last 20 years. So what happens is that a pharmaceutical company will come to the Department of Health with the price, and the Department of Health will say no. Then there will be a lot of bargaining will go on for a period of time. And then we will have a lot of very sensitive personal testimonies from people then that could benefit from this medication. Then there will be pressure on backbench TDs. They will come out into the public arena. The Department of Health will keep saying no until eventually the government will say yes. And then, as happened in this case here, then the HSE are presenting this as a victory for them because they've negotiated the price down. Well, see, the pharmaceutical companies have come in with a big price, knowing well it gives them room to negotiate. And that's the way of it. Now, I have somebody within my family network who works for a pharmaceutical company. And what she says is that many drugs that pharmaceutical companies do research on never get to trial. And only one out of every 20 drugs that get to trial ever meet the marketplace because they're deemed to be efficient and they have minimal side effects. There are a lot of others that can do the job as well, but they have catastrophic side effects. So pharmaceutical companies, then that one drug then has got to pay for the other 19 trials that didn't work. And the other drugs that didn't go to trial. And of course, a patent will only last for a company then for about 8 to 10 years, which means that all comers can come into the marketplace then, do their own version of the drug. It's called a generic brand, and that's the end of the windfall profits for the company then. So that's the bizarre way that we deal with it. However, we have a problem in this country, I suppose, in the fact we need to
But
take
just
costs
into that
out of it.
pharmaceutical
Somebody
thing, yeah,
somewhere has
but
got to make a decision.
I do get that. But just in relation to that, I mean, the pharmaceutical companies, I think, have to have a bit of a moral background here because they're striking deals with Germany and they might charge 100 quid a dose there and then come to us and say 250. You know, that I mean, I have no sympathy for pharmaceutical companies, and I'm not saying you do either. I understand they have to recoup, but they don't have to gouge per se. And also, can we not do things differently? I was under the impression, and I'm only just recalling this, that, you know, there has been precedent, or at least there is some provision for companies to group countries to group together. Like, are we approaching Portugal and saying, can we negotiate for this particular drug as a unit rather than, you know, us as small fry trying to, I was almost 100% sure we can, as a block, if we choose, or countries can work together. So, in other words, are we exhausting every opportunity to get the best value and get these life-saving drugs to those that need them?
But it's not the fault of the pharmaceutical companies, Greg, because they're in the business of making money,
No, that
period.
is, it is.
But it is our
There's a
fault if
moral
we,
question there, Paddy.
I found this, I mean, I was begog when I heard this, that each individual company in Europe is dealing with the pharmaceutical company. Is it not beyond the European Union to come together and to do this collectively? Because whatever kind of medical profile you have, the population in Ireland, you have the very same one
Well,
in Germany.
I also thought we did that with
Our
the.
fault,
I
actually.
think we also did that with the COVID jabs that we did negotiate collectively. I thought that was the case. Then there was some concern about how they were being divvied out by way of population. So, as I say, I think there is precedent there. But we can tease that out, Paddy, and I will come back to you. I want to bring Jimmy Brogan in here because, you know, at the end of the day, someone listening to this who's affected by it, and Paddy's conscious of this completely. It's not that it's his is a reality perspective. The truth is why should five people are sick who are sick have less chance of living, you know, than 5,000 people that are sick? It doesn't. But does it rest easy with you, or do you understand the finances of it, Jimmy?
I don't understand the finances of it. At the end of the day, you know, these private companies are they're like, as you said, Greg, their main objective is to make profit, you know, and it's far if the healthcare needs of the Irish people or the European people are far from their thoughts, like, you know. So, and I think it's, when does it become, when does a person become, you know, a life that's too expensive to save, you know? And, you know, you mentioned the European Union. You know, we seem to get the worst of the European Union all the time, because if there's anything that's beneficial for Ireland in the European Union, it seems to be out of reach, and there's all the kinds of rules and regulations that we have to adhere to then, because we're in the European Union. Like, you know, I don't see why the European Union can't, as a whole, negotiate this, you know, these prices for these pharmaceuticals. Like, you know, because at the end of the day, the people in Ireland have as much right to these pharmaceuticals, these medicines, as the people in Germany or the people in France. You know, I know we're a smaller country, a smaller mass of people, but we still should have the same rights as the people in every other part of Europe, like, you know. And you know, and we can't leave it to the pharmaceutical companies, because, as you said, their main the main thing they have in their head is to make money, like, you know. And sometimes you just wonder about the moral compass of these companies, like, you know. And you know, have they any thought for the people at all? Because it's unbelievable that they can charge the amount of money they're charging for a drug. And I understand that they have to make money. You know, at the end of the day, you won't have them unless they're making money. But at the same time, you know, they have to have a social conscience, and they have to make sure that you know, and especially the government and the European authorities, you know, they have to make sure that everybody's treated equally. And I thought that's what the European Union is about. But it doesn't seem to be when it comes to Ireland a lot of the time.
At what point do, though, we have to make a cold, hard decision, Jimmy, because, you know, money is not infinite. You know, there does come a point whereby we have to say, well, we can't afford that treatment. Sorry.
Yeah, well, I know there has to be, but it's difficult to know where that point is, because, you know, as they say, it doesn't matter what money it's going to cost. It's somebody's life or a number of people's lives they're usually talking about, you know. And I think it's incumbent on the pharmaceutical companies really to make sure that they're not just there to make profit. You know, I think originally they were probably set up, pharmacists were trying to do the right thing, you know. The original, you know, medicine people, you know, were trying to create something that was going to help people and save people, rather than just create something that's going to make money. And unfortunately, the capitalist system we're in, that's just the way it is. People are there to make money first. You know, the same with other companies. They're not insurance companies aren't there to provide insurance. They're there to make money. So pharmaceutical companies aren't there to provide medicines. They're there to make money, you know. And that's, unfortunately, that's just the way that the world has gone, like, you know. But I don't know what number. I wouldn't like to put a number on it as to how high it would be. But I think the pharmaceutical companies have a lot to answer for, and that, you know, they can basically, as you say, ask for any price they want and keep coming down until they get their medicine sold, you know.
Just
at the
before
price
I bring Porrig in, do you want to push back on that at all, Paddy, that it is just completely about money? I presume there are people that go to college for, you know, 7, 10 years to try and make a difference to humanity.
Well, it's not all about that. But I think what's morally reprehensible, Greg, is that there are medications available in countries in the European Union at whatever price, and then that they're not available in this country. We're all a member of the European Union, and there's supposed to be a common bond between us. This is going to continue time after time until we address that power imbalance, because the pharmaceutical companies are not going to come down off their high horse and give away some of their massive profits. They're not going to do that. Mm. And the only way you're going to address that is about all the other countries coming together and actually turn themselves from being a price taker into a price maker. And at the moment, the pharmaceutical companies have a huge advantage in that area, and that advantage is going to remain until the European Union doesn't get its house in order.
Okay. Well, in cases like a global pandemic, the EU does negotiate with these companies on bloc, and we do negotiate for some drugs with other countries as well. But if our tipping point is 45,000 euro because we're worried about money, and Belgium's is 100,000 because they want to get the drug quicker to them, the negotiation position becomes very, very complicated, for an example.
Yes, but we shouldn't be, if that, I mean, the, you know, we're either in the European Union collectively, Greg, or we're not. I mean, I agree with Jimmy then. I mean, that's completely reprehensible for the European Union to behave in that particular way, that some of the countries are prepared to go to X because they're in a financial position to do that. We happen to be in a place now, Greg, in this country that we can do that because the government is not saying no to anything now, as far as I can see. But what's going to happen when the music stops and all this largesse that we don't have? What are we going to do then? It's actually going to exasperate our difficulty even further.
Okay, the European Union is a bit of a basket case when you dig into it. We can sort of look at it in this romantic way, but when you dig into things like this, the disparity in women's rights, LGBT rights, et cetera, it really is actually not hardly a union at all, especially when it feels like sometimes we're so disadvantaged by being a part of it. But Deputy McLaughlin's been waiting patiently. There's a lot to digest there from the two lads. What do you think, Porrig, on this issue? Have you stopped speaking or are you muted? I wonder. Maybe I can't
hear
you.
No, I should be okay.
No, I've got you. I've got you. Go ahead.
Apologies. Yeah. So I agree with a lot of what's been said already. There's two things to say. We take too long to make a decision. What happened with the people with living with Friedreich's ataxia, which is obviously a desperately difficult challenge to live with, and Skyclarys was available in other European countries, and it's what's referred to as an orphan drug because it's only for a small number of people, as Paddy has said already. So we need to clearly pool together in Europe. You shouldn't have a situation where people living, for example, I'm aware right now of a family in Donegal where the man is fighting for his life, and the drug that may save his life is available across the border, but it's not available here, and we're waiting on a decision, and there's no workaround. So it's extremely painful for people who are living with this, and it takes too long. Our government need to lead the way on demanding a European-wide approach. Obviously, at European level, they approve these drugs, so you need to have now a pooling together where you are, as Paddy says, the price maker rather than the price taker. And the way we're doing things right now is deeply unfair to those who are living with these challenges and indeed fighting for their lives in many instances.
How do we negotiate, though, with the pharmaceutical companies? Because it's they that hold the IP, right? It's they that have that. And you can, it's all right us saying that, and Irish people might get behind that. But you say German people, how would the German government sell this? Sorry, folks. There might not be drugs coming down the line because we're with Ireland here fighting with the pharmaceutical companies. Like, I know what you're saying, and that would be a lovely thing to do, but in reality, that's never going to happen, is it?
Well, no, it can happen, and you've given the pandemic as an example. We need to have a European Union-wide approach to the price of these drugs, and that's where you negotiate with strength. Right now, on paper, Ireland is a small, wealthy country. These pharmaceutical companies know that, and as has been said, there'll be a campaign, pressure will be applied politically. No public representative would ever say, I want somebody to die earlier than they should or live in pain and be denied a drug. So they know the
Okay.
game plan, the
So
pharmaceutical companies.
just to wrap it up, I'll go back through then. From what I'm hearing, and maybe you just didn't get a chance to address it, and I'll start with you, Porrig. You do accept that there has to be, do you, a threshold, and it's not necessarily up to us to dig deeper, to increase that €45,000 per year of life or improved life to 200. It's the pharmaceutical companies that need to come to the negotiating table. So you're not saying to the government or the HSE or whomever's responsible to loosen the purse strings then, are you?
Well, you can't have a blank checkbook for the pharmaceutical companies. And in fairness, that's the purpose of this body, the National Centre for Pharmaeconomics. But what I'm saying is right now, we're negotiating from a position of weakness as a small country. And we need to unite across the European Union, negotiate as one bloc, and get the fairest price and have then the same drug being available to European citizens all across. And right now, the way it's positioned right now isn't working. It's failing our people.
Yeah, and I mean, even if something like they negotiated with a single country, and then everyone else had a chance to opt in at that price or something. So in other words, you wouldn't have a smaller country playing much more. There has to be some sort of a way to make it more fair and equitable, Paddy.
Well, absolutely. And the only way that you can do that, because there is no incentive at the moment, Greg, for pharmaceutical companies to change their position. Why would they? They're in the business of making money, nothing else, period. Right. Whatever good they do in society, it's like the companies that make alcohol and vapes and cigarettes. They're all in the business of making money as well. Right. I'm not comparison pharma. Are harmful to society. The only way that we're ever going to change the dynamic in this is change our bargaining position. Mm. As Padraig said, we're a very small country on the edge of Europe. We're deemed to be, on the outset at the very least, a very wealthy company or country at the present time, and pharmaceutical companies know how far they can go with us. But if they were dealing with a block of 360 million people instead of a block of 5 million people, well, you know, there is an expectation that the dynamic would be very different there.
And there is an irony that we rely so heavily on pharmaceutical companies in this country. You just wonder where that would leave us in terms of baring our teeth on such an issue.
Eli Lilly, for instance, is one of the three companies that that pay over 50% of the total corporation tax in this country. So...
it's frustrating because then you throw in the social media companies and really, well, what are we ever going to do? Jimmy, you know, I think, and we're all conscious of this, at the end of the day, can you imagine, and maybe you can, and I'm sure you've spoken to people in your own constituency, and we all have, if you're on the other end of this, like the family that Padraig mentioned, you know, really, it all comes down to, well, this is all waffle, we need this drug, but unfortunately, life is more complicated than that.
Yeah, well, Greg, like we all could be on that side of the that side of the thing very soon. We don't know what's ahead of us, you know. Any of us could come down with any sort of a illness or disease, like, you know, and we could be in a position where we need that 40-50,000 euro drug, you know. So we just don't know. But listen, they're all right. We can't, you know, as Padraig said, we can't give them an open checkbook, because the pharmaceutical companies will take advantage of it. Mm. And as Paddy said, they're there to make money. But we need our so-called European partners to step up to the plate now as well. Like, you know, as Paddy said, 360 million people have a lot more bargaining power than the 5.6 million people that's here in Ireland, you know. And it is sickening when you see these drugs that are available across the border, a couple of miles away from Donegal. And it's happened a couple of times. And next thing now, they're not available here because they're out of price. Like, and I don't know what the price they would pay in Northern Ireland for, but, you know, I'm sure that the price is a lot lower than it is here. And, you know, our so-called, as I call them, our so-called European partners, sometimes we're a very poor end of this partnership, like, you know. And I think it's up to the European, to our health minister and the other European health ministers to get together to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen, that we do, we negotiate with these companies as a large block of 360 million people or whatever it is.
Like, well, don't be too harsh on the EU. I mean, look what they've done for our farming and fishing industries. Be fair.
They've wrecked our fishing industry.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. Sorry.
They've given money to our farmers, but they've wrecked the fishing industry. That's a thing of the past.
Oh, no, the farmers are next. Don't worry about that. That money's going to be...
Can I just say, Greg, sorry, before we close off there, because I was just thinking when Jimmy was speaking there about... You know, we're talking about medication now for a small number of people, and this will improve their lives. But I would love to know, what is the totality of the pharmaceutical budget that we pay pharmaceutical companies every year for medications through the GMS and for medications that people pay over the counter? I mean, we must be talking about billions upon billions here. The amount of money that we're talking about for the families that are the people that are affected by Friedrich's ataxia is probably very small, actually, in comparison to the totality of the bill. I mean, the money that this country is spending on pharmaceuticals right across the board, it's probably equal to the gross domestic
3.2 billion. Is the annual spend the HSE has on pharmaceutical expenditure. It's around about 13% of the total Irish public health budget. Wow, not insignificant. All right, good point. We're in the middle of the Friday panel, which is great, of course. And our guests today are Deputy Padraig McLaughlin, Paddy Rooney, Chair of Friends of Letty County University Hospital, and Councillor Jimmy Brogan. Right, now, and all of you texting, we'll get to that. Interesting, so I was just looking during the break. We spend about 12% of our health budget on drugs, which is kind of the same as countries in the northern part of Europe, but in the likes of Portugal, Spain, they spend a quarter of their budget on drugs, but there's more factors in there that you would have to consider as well. Last question, with non-religious families now making up a growing proportion of our communities, is it time the Department of Education mandated alternative structured subjects like ethics, human rights or STEM for children opting out of faith formation in Catholic primary schools rather than just, in inverted commas, leaving them at the back of the classroom? And this is off the back, Councillor Jimmy Brogan of Atheist Ireland calling for classes for, you know, atheist children that they can take part in whilst religion is being taught in the schools. What do you think?
Yeah, listen, I think there's a place for a lot more non-denominational schools. Obviously, if people want to send their children to a faith school, then that's fine. But you look at the portion of people that are actually engaged in their faith, you know, going to mass or going to church, you know, I think schools should be, you know, teaching all religions, you know, teaching about all religious beliefs and ethics. And, you know, that, you know, people of every religion and no religion should be treated equally, like, you know, nobody should be disadvantaged for it, like, you know. And, you know, there's a big conversation we had whether faith formation, you know, sacraments and stuff should be taught outside
school
time.
Well, we had that really, and the majority of parents voted for religion to stay within the schools. That's we're just off the back of finding that out.
Well, a lot of places there is no non-denominational school, like, you know, so yeah, it's a Catholic school or nothing, or a church school,
yeah,
or whatever. And I have nothing against church schools. The Irish people have got a great education over many, many years, you know, but I think it's about choice for parents. Okay. And if people want to send their children to a non-denominational school, I think them schools should be available for people. And, you know, things...
So more non-denominational schools,
more non-denominational schools
than us trying to accommodate atheist children within religious schools then? Or both?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, everybody has to be, I think it should be available to people, like, you know. I know there's, like, a lot of girl schools and that, you know, are non-denominational or interdenominational, which is a great thing as well, you know.
Okay.
But, you know, I think it's up to the communities, really. If communities come together and want to set up, I know that, unfortunately, there's a lot of schools closing, like, you know, we don't have many children as we had, and you see a lot of smaller schools, a couple of schools that didn't open yesterday and won't open now in the beginning of September, and the same last year. Unfortunately, when you look at the numbers going to school, there's going to be a lot of schools that won't open next year. That, unfortunately, that's the situation, like, you know. But I think it's about choice for people, really.
Okay, a minute each, if you don't mind, Paddy. I'll go to you first.
Well, I suppose very briefly, the survey by the Department of Education in June of this year of parents in primary school. I mean, in rural areas in Donegal, it was something 4-1 to maintain the status quo. The schools in Letterkenny, with the exception, I think, of the Ballyrene School, because it's got a Church of Ireland ethos, it begins to tighten up a little bit, 60-40. And as you move east in the country, it becomes sort of 55-45. What am I saying about this? What I'm saying is that there is a large cohort of people out there who are not happy now with the status quo. The majority of people are. But I think there's an ever-increasing number who are not. And I think with the upcoming change in the profile of the population, with a lot of new Irish coming, they won't have white faces. They won't be speaking English. Christianity is not their first faith and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but what
and
we actually, will likely
happen
see...
What will happen too, that, by the way, yep. Some of the people that are going to be sitting beside Padraig McLaughlin on the benches are going to be coming from these countries as well. So change.
But they may well, yeah, but many from those other countries may want to actually form their own schools. And that's likely, we've seen it elsewhere, and have probably very strict criteria on what religion is or isn't taught in those schools as well. They're not all going to necessarily be absorbed into the...
No, they may not. But if you look at classes, you know, for first-year classes, they'll be in the newspaper now at the end of the month about the new classes coming to the schools in Letterkenny. You're going to see a lot of new words in those pictures.
Which will anger people, which is really quite sad. Some people, I should say. A minute to you, Padraig, if you don't mind. I'm going to have to be a bit of a Cathaoirleach here. Oh, Cam Corla, sorry.
Yeah, no, listen, we have educated together in Letterkenny, so we've been example of when parents come together and look for a school that doesn't have a religious ethos. But we also have a lot of people who do want their children educated, as Paddy said, in Donegal, in a predominantly Catholic or Christian ethos, and that's fine too. We can accommodate both. But the challenge for government is to make sure that they work with communities across the country and they respond to the needs of people. Right now, I wouldn't say we've got the balance right and we can do better.
Okay, really? You're getting good at this. All right. Thanks very much indeed. Enjoy your weekend, Padraig McLaughlin. Thanks for accepting the invite as always. Paddy Rooney, it's always a pleasure. We'll see you really soon. And Jimmy, great to have you on board. Thanks so much for your views and your comments. Very much appreciated.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks once again to our guests, Paddy and Jimmy. And also, too, thank you to all of you who've been messaging in so far. We'll start with drug costs, will we? Hi, Greg. Repurchase price of drugs. If the Irish government can farm out medical treatment to other countries, example, the cross-border scheme, why can't they do the same for people needing special drugs that are rare? The one thing I'll say, and it's not to contradict you, that maybe not everyone is fully aware, is that a lot of people actually come here and get treatment as well as part of that scheme. We're not just sending out the way. People do come here as well, believe it or not. In Spain, my experience is a free doctor and medicine is just pennies. That comes in from Jane. All right, thanks very much for that insight. I do appreciate it. Ensuring that citizens can access critical treatment maintains a healthier, more productive workforce. Preventative and life-saving care often reduces long-term down-the-road costs, such as emergency room visits or long-term disability support. Yeah, indeed. That spend a little now, save a lot into the future. There's no doubt about the sense that that can be the right thing to do. Government budgets are limited. Spending millions on ultra-expensive treatments for a small number of people means fewer funds for primary care, infrastructure, education, other public services. I disagree with it. Yeah, and I fully get where you're coming from, and I understand exactly where you're coming from. I'm glad I don't have to make that decision, if that makes sense. I really am. Right, now, we have to be realistic. If we keep giving into these huge pharmaceutical companies for huge fees, how will they ever see the costs come down? No, Greg, this is not a legitimate question. If people need treatment, it should be provided. Look at all the wasted money spent in Ireland by government. What's next? Euthanasia because nursing homes are not available, or abortion because it costs X amount to cater for the health needs of a child with Down syndrome? Talking about limited health care because of money is a slippery slope to euthanasia, they believe. Well, we are heading towards that, don't you know? That is being progressed, it has to be said, because we are seeing big moves to have that introduced here. I mean, not a lot of people call it euthanasia, but you know what I mean. This is the problem with capitalism that drives pharma, AI, social media, etc. They do not care for humanity, but only the bigger buck. We pay for it financially, socially, environmentally, and with all points to humanity's self-destruction, as they have no ethics and only care about making money and being all-powerful. We discussed, too, after Andy Burnham, the UK Prime Minister, stating that a border poll, the question is off the table for now. Many of you messaging in on that topic, of course, as well. Hi, Greg. Car tax in the Republic, €180, plus in the North, car tax, €39. Makes you wonder, where does the money go in the Republic when you see the state of Irish roads? I remember, and maybe this is a myth, I don't know what you guys think out there, but I remember when I was younger, you would know when you were in the North because of the conditions of the roads, so that you'd be driving in the Republic and, you know, narrow roads, and as I say, this is going back quite some time, then you would cross the border and you'd feel like you'd just entered this other universe. As I say, this is my memory. But I do recall there was a point where it felt like the reverse of that, whereby our roads seemed to be much better than the roads in Northern Ireland. As I say, that's only anecdotal and just something I remember. The people of the North would be mad to leave the UK, believes a listener, to join the Republic. Our decisions are made in Brussels. We're not Ireland, we are the EU. People in the North need to realise they would be joining the EU. We do not have as much say when it comes to immigration. We cannot control our country because of decisions made in the EU. What I will say to that as well, if you don't mind, immigrant boats, the influx of immigrants into Britain has actually increased post-Brexit, even though they have control of their borders, because they're probably not getting as much cooperation with other countries as well. Financially, the country's in a far worse condition in terms of many, many metrics. And in fact, there is, and I think it's inevitable, that Britain will eventually rejoin the EU. So I take your view, I'm just putting that out there as a sort of a counter-narrative. Can't imagine 26, hardly want six more people struggling enough, they say. A listener, thanks. Can we in Donegal vote to become a member of Britain? And if we do, does that mean we're going to get better planning and infrastructure within the county? As I say, a lot of the comments really are not necessarily directly addressing the question, but are understandably framed in a dissatisfaction with the running of the 26 counties. The new Prime Minister has spent more time in the Irish clubs and spent more time focusing on the Irish community than any other Prime Minister. He's right about his decision. Many Irish Catholics have no interest in a united Ireland. Another, are we moving backwards? United Ireland referendum, which is part of the Good Friday Agreement. Is he now deciding that the Good Friday Agreement is void? Drumcree given permission to march again in an area where they're not wanted. I think what he's saying is that the polls that are out there don't show support for United Ireland at this point. And with that in mind, it's off the table. The Good Friday Agreement still stands, and he never said anything really that to the letter would be contrary to the Good Friday Agreement, I don't think, open to correction. Another, the Irish government can't look after the Irish people and the counties they already have. You're asking the people of Northern Ireland to give up their free education, to give up their free healthcare, to join a system that's already crumbling. No, no, no to United Ireland, they say. I live in the west coast of Donegal and drive to Northern Ireland at least twice a month to do a big shop, such as clothing and shopping. Everything is so much cheaper. And then on the way out, I buy petrol because that's cheaper too. The people of Northern Ireland would be off their heads to vote yes. Last on this for now, Dublin doesn't care about us here in Donegal when it comes to planning and services. Do any of the panel realistically believe they'll treat the North any different? Yeah, well, that's, religion in school, it's hard to counter that. Religion in school. Greg, here's a big surprise for you and your panel. There are no religions in heaven. All religions are man-made and should be abolished. There is one faith, and that is the faith that Jesus Christ practiced. And when Christ returns, which is not too far away, this caller believes all religions will be obliterated. I would love to know, and this might sound like I'm being facetious or what, I would love to know what in what form people believe that that might happen if it were to happen, and why might it be now? On that issue as well of religion in schools. So why should we, tax-paying majority Catholic, have to put the recent survey results at the bottom of policy to provide the demands of the new imported atheist pretend Irish? Well, listen, if you look at the religious breakdowns of people coming into this country, it's a mix, and atheism is very low down on that. That's an internal issue. I know we all want to sort of try and make everything about immigration, but that's an internal issue if you look at the people that are speaking about it. Non-denominational schools are not so much for kids with no religion. It's about Muslims not wanting to send their kids to Christian schools. I'm not sure about that because there's no religion taught in those schools. Good morning, Greg. School should remain under its own faith, regardless of who's in the school, especially of foreign extraction. Another, we need our Catholic teaching in our schools. If other religions don't want to go to our schools, they can go to other schools elsewhere. Now, Doreen Sheridan Kennedy is a regular guest, or has been a regular guest on this programme. She is a devout politician, a devout Fine Gael politician. There's just absolutely no doubt about that. But she's also a very interesting lady, a woman of faith herself, a family woman, a woman who in her youth, and all of this will come out in the podcast, in her youth was very clear about rights, the rights of women. That was probably bestowed to her by her mother, who was a bit of a leader in that regard as well. Doreen was never one to refuse an opportunity and say, right, I want to do that, I'm going to do that. And that all comes out in the podcast. Doreen is this week's The Greg Hughes Podcast guest. And we also talk about politics, as you can imagine. She also as is the way, you know, me and her have a little bit of a bit of tension there at times, just as we both make our various points, but it's all in good faith and in all in good spirits. And Doreen is a lovely lady. And we pick up the conversation, because we're going to play out a bit of a preview of the podcast for you. We pick up the conversation here. She's got a job in teaching now. She's going to move back to Donegal and is deciding that she wants to get into, you know, the union side of things for better conditions, better terms for teachers, and by default then for pupils.
Well, I was part of the NGO when I was in Dublin, but couldn't really get involved because I went home at weekends, but I got involved as soon as I came back here. And funny enough, I'm still involved with some of the same people on the Retired Teachers Association, like Anne McKinley there, who was chair at the time and I was secretary. And here we are now, she's in our committee and I'm the secretary of the RTEA for West Donegal. So there's an interest there, and there always was, you know, just to important of your, it's the rights, that your rights. My father was very involved with his union as a worker.
And how much of a union is about the welfare of teachers, and how much of it, like the likes of the INTO, is about the welfare of the school environment and the students?
Well, it has to be about, the union is for the teachers.
Yeah.
The INTO, the Irish National Teachers.
No, I know
teachers.
That, but so I mean, that's the, in name.
The sort of agenda that we took and the motions that we put in from our branch would be in relation to, you know, well, to make sure that we had the rights, that we had our maternity leaves, that we had all the sick leave that we needed, that we were entitled to. If I was working on an island, I was entitled to a grant, all this kind of things. But then we had motions going on about special education. We had motions going on about English as an additional language. We had motions going on about accommodation, about building, and about helping. So it's a broad spectrum. The union was, we always kept a vision of what was, but we were a trade union for teachers, and that had to be that we looked after the welfare of our teachers. And I'm not sure if that's still a big priority.
I think. Talk to me about that. What do you mean?
I think it's changed, and that we're sometimes getting into social issues that maybe aren't ours to get involved in. You know, especially, I suppose, maybe when you're living in Dublin, there's different issues that would...
Are you on about what's taught in schools, sex education?
Well, not even now what's taught, but the likes of maybe teachers in Dublin trying to get accommodation. So for them, it's a huge issue.
Yeah.
Well, it's not an issue for us. Though I know when we were in Arnmore Island, we were fighting, and we went to union meetings fighting for accommodation for teachers on the island. So maybe the problems are there in a different way, no matter where you are. And at the end of the day, I'm not sure that we're listened to well enough within education. I don't think that we're, you know, when the government are talking about things, education to me is way down here.
Yeah.
Whereas we're not part of the five or six, it should be up there. And if there was more planning.
And has education slipped down that pecking order a bit over the years?
No, I think we've very good representation. I think John Boyle, as a general secretary, has done marvellous work, as has John Carr beforehand, good Donegal people. But I just feel there's so many other things that have come up the way, like the whole migration thing is, you know, housing for people, the MICA issue, the whole health
cost
services,
of living.
You know what I mean? So there's lots of things there. And at the end of the day, school is very much part of a lot of our lives, whether you're working in it or whether
you're... Well, a bad decision now has ramifications for a generation.
That's right. You talk recently, you know, about union things. I know when I was in the Equality Committee, we were fighting to get leave for women and families that had had miscarriages. And it's only come to fruition in the last few weeks in government. Thank God, through a nice Fine Gael woman. And we were, you know, that takes years. It takes years to get things in, to get law enforced and to get things into practice and to legally look at stuff. So
you mentioned politics. I mean, obviously, you're a teacher. You're a mum. You're a union representative or active within a union and very vocal in the that space, and then politics as well. At what stage did you become, I suppose, not necessarily interested in politics, but more active within politics?
Well, like that, there was a party going one night, and I decided I would go to the party.
Right.
Literally, Paddy Hart was celebrating so many years, and my friend Mairead Crummish, again, the Crummish is Lower Main Street. There were tickets going, and I said, you know what, Red, we'll go to that. And we went out to that. And I was enthralled and intrigued with the whole political thing. But that was sort of on a front that here I was back in town. This is something I couldn't get into. But in saying that, you know, my father and mother were very involved in politics. So I think that might have...
Activism, elected politics?
Although they were active. My father would have been very much part of a Letterkenny branch of Fine Gael and would have been run as a candidate himself. with Paddy Hart back in the 50s and 60s. Mm. And my mother was part of sort of a rebel age where her Uncle Tom went with Dev and her father in civil politics went.
So it was almost inevitable, right?
So, yeah, because that's the type of person I was, you know. So,
but of all the siblings, are you the one that's most involved in politics?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And that's great. Life is politics. Life is political. Anyone who thinks it's not is needs to be very aware everything is political, whether it's decisions on hubs and hospitals, whether it's decision on, we'll say, Illestrin getting a new school, whether it's decisions on, yourself getting
Further all the positive things you've mentioned so far, but I take your points.
Yeah.
Right. Watching the video back there, if you like dad bods, I think I wore a sit-down shirt. There are stand-up shirts and sit-down shirts, and I wore a stand-up shirt for a sit-down interview. But anyway, be that as it may, that podcast available for you from 11 a.m. And as I say, it's a wide-ranging podcast about Doreen and her life and politics and a window into the past as well, and active unionism. Or being in a union, active within a union, is what I'm trying to say. So that's that podcast live for you at 11 a.m. And there's dozens of them there for you, back catalogued. Some amazing guests from all different backgrounds, music, entertainment, politics, sport, and then people who've, campaigned for services for their children, people that have overcome or have dealt with rare diseases. There's so many different stories in there for you. So you can check it all out on the website, the Greg Hughes Podcast on HighlandRadio.com, or search it wherever you get the podcasts. And if you want to see me in a stand-up shirt sitting down, you can watch them on YouTube weekly as well. Right. We're going to be heading to Electric Picnic soon. Donna Marie Doherty and Shannon Wilkins are down there. Donna Marie Doherty struggling with internet coverage. Shannon, not so much, I'm told, but we shall see. Saddened yesterday evening, as many were, to learn of the passing of former elected representative Enda Bonner from Dunloe, former senator, former councillor. Brilliant on the field of play as well. A great servant to his region and to his county. And he passed away aged 76 at Letterkenny University Hospital, and he'll be sadly missed, of course, by his loving and devoted wife Phyllis, his children Elaine, Elizabeth, Patrick, his adoring grandchildren Brooke, Mason, Connell and Elodie, also missed by sisters Pauline, Aideen, Crona, his nephews, nieces, cousins, extended family, friends and colleagues, and friends in the GEA community, and not least his political colleagues, but his friend. And that very clearly is where you sit, Deputy Pat the Coke Gallagher. I mean, obviously we're paying tribute to a man who contributed so much, but my condolences to you initially, and are very much a part of your life, and it's a personal loss for you as well.
Well, both Enda and I grew up in Dunloe together, and we played football together, and about this time, 60 years ago, we played together in McCool Park in Ballybuffet, where Dunloe won the first of three minor championships, 66, 67 and 68. I played in the first one, too old for the others, but Enda played in the next one. And he was an exceptional player, but my mind rolls back to that time. And also to 1972, when Enda graced Croke Park, when he came on the field against Galway in that year, the All-Ireland semi-final. He was a very, very strong defender in many ways. But of course, I roll on till 1979 when I put my name forward for the council at that time. And Enda was very much a part of my team in 79 for the council and 81 for the Dáil and its subsequent elections. He himself had the honour of being appointed as one of the 11 by Taoiseach Bertie Ahern in 1997 when I was in Europe, and elected to the council in 99, chairman of the council, which is a great honour for any councillor, 2006 to 2007. Enda was a proud Rosses man, a dedicated public representative, and of course he'll be sadly missed by all of us, but particularly by his wife Phyllis and his children, Elaine, Patrick, Elizabeth, and his children.
Yeah, how would you define him politically? I mean, obviously incredibly determined, and that reflected in the polls being returned to office as often as he had. He came across to me as a tough cookie, you know. Go on.
Well, he reflected what he had on the field in politics, a great defender, and Enda was a great defender. He was very independent in his views, somewhat times maybe contrary to what maybe the party would be thinking. But Enda represented the views of his people and those in the Glenties electoral area that he represented. And he just wasn't a senator for Donegal. He was a senator for the entire country, because when you're appointed by the Taoiseach, you're a national senator. No, he was very determined, very independent in his views, and never afraid to speak out. Very committed to developments in West Donegal over that period that he was on Donegal County Council, and never, as I said, never afraid to speak out, whether it was popular or unpopular. Enda wasn't just making statements for popularity, but he was making statements because he believed in what he was saying.
And not unlike yourself, and you know the best of public servants as well. You do a lot when you're elected, but it's also the stuff that you do for your local club or your local community when you don't necessarily have the deputy or the councillor or the senator title.
Well, of course, Andrew's very committed to the GAA. Grew up in Dunloe, played underage football, under 14. I recall, I think he had under 14, under 16, under 18 medals during his time in playing for Dunloe. And then, of course, played with Dunloe, Rosses Rovers for a period. And he was totally committed to the GAA, was an active member of the Dunloe executive. Then, of course, he represented Dunloe at county executive level right up until his death. He was still a member of the county board and spoke his mind there. He was an exceptional person. Mm. And, of course, he came back from Dublin to set up a practice in Letterkenny many, many years ago, and had business and dealing with businesses throughout all of the county, and was highly respected in the business world as well.
Thank you very much, Deputy Pat the Colt Gallagher. Brendan Byrne, good morning to you. And again, I know your political lives, what personal life intertwined with Enda Boner. So it's, you know, we can pay tribute to his contribution to life, but also condolences to you on the loss of someone you were closely associated with as well.
Thank you very much, Greg. It was with great shock and sadness that we learned of Enda's passing. And there was a very committed public representative, hard work, and he was dedicated. He had a great social conscience in everything that he did. He very much was motivated for the underdog in life. And I think that's what empowered him in politics to continue on and to fight for West Donegal and for rural issues. And he was a colossus in politics, really. And despite his tough exterior, and more often than not, wore his heart on his sleeve in politics. There was a very soft side to Enda, but that's not to take from... He was a formidable debater, and I certainly wouldn't like to come up against him in debates, because Enda would not pull back. He would always defend to the last his area and the people that he represented, and he did a very good job as a public representative.
I saw a great picture of you and he, you in the council. You look about 12, and he looks the same. He looks the same.
Yeah.
But from that picture, what I took from it, though, was influence, you know, and sometimes we believe that, you know, if you're Fianna Fáil or you're Fine Gael or you're independent or you're Sinn Féin, that never the twain shall meet. But I'm sure there's a lot of new councillors, a lot of fresh-faced politicians, regardless of the political background, that he, as someone who had been there and done that, was there to sort of offer support and advice or a word of encouragement.
Yeah, very much so. I remember the first day I went to Lifford. I was elected in 2004, somewhat of a surprise. And I arrived in Lifford and I said, I met Enda at the door by chance. And I said, "Now, what do I do?" He says, "Listen, Brendan, sit beside me and I'll keep you right." And that's exactly what happened. I sat beside him for the years that I was on Donegal County Council, I was lucky to be chosen as his vice chairman when he was chairman in 2006. He was a great mentor, and that was one thing that was a strong trait of Enda's. He was always there to support people and to bring out the best in people. And that's something you'll never forget. You know, he was, his trademark was loyalty. He was very loyal to his friends and supportive of his friends. And, you know, people like that are not that plentiful nowadays. We become intransient to the world, and the world is a much busier place than what it was 20 years ago. But Enda was very loyal, and even up until recently, you would get the phone call from Enda, and you needed to be prepared to be on the phone for an hour when he would ring. But those are the memories that we will have for long and many a day now that he has passed to his eternal reward.
Indeed. And what a legacy that his family can lean on at this most difficult of time, that he contributed so much and was thought so highly of. Hopefully eases the loss with time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Brendan Byrne. And I bumped into and... I'm not sure of the timeline. I think it was last year. And I don't really have a relationship with any politician sort of outside of my job. So you don't really necessarily know how you might be received if you bump into them. And he was very, very kind and gracious to me. And it was like, oh, okay, well, Enda doesn't hate me. He must think I'm okay. And that gave me a wee pep, as I say, because you don't know, not that what I feel matters, but my point is I came away thinking I don't really know him personally such, because I never had that opportunity. But he was very warm, a nice handshake and a lovely smile too. May he rest in peace, and our thoughts and prayers with his family and his friends. And we send love, support and strength to you at this difficult time for you all. It's frustrating, you know, that so often many of us have to fight for stuff, fight for the basics, become not just mums and dads or carers or caregivers, but also campaigners. And Gemma joins me now and finds herself in that position. Gemma, thank you for chatting to me. I appreciate it.
Hi, Greg.
Right. Now, you've been in a battle for school transport with Bus Éireann since June. Take us through the situation facing you and your child.
It started, yeah, back in June, and I was told that my daughter would be accepted for the school transport. However, Bus Éireann will not be able to do this route, which I know the route has actually already been done before. A child has been taken from Burton Port, but it's also been done for other children, vice versa, coming from the mainland to the secondary school in Arnmore. So why can't it be done for my daughter?
Now, you live on the island, don't you? So you're talking about...
I live in Arnmore.
You're talking about coming in to Burton Port and then getting a bus from Burton Port to the school?
Yes, up in Dunloe, yeah.
You were told initially it would be okay. You know in the past it has been done. Have you been told now why this option's not going to be available for your child?
I'm not getting any explanation. I'm just getting this route cannot be done. And I've written amounts of emails. I've phone called, left voice messages, and I'm getting nothing back. But one message I got back recently was, I'll pass this on to my manager. But then again, it has gone no further.
Now, this is sometimes where things don't make sense. There has been an offer of you to sort of compensate you per kilometre from Burton Port to the school, but it doesn't factor in the fact that you would be on and off a ferry four times in a day just to get a child to and from school.
Yeah, they weren't taken into consideration that we do have the ocean between us. The ferry itself is a 20-minute journey. And for me to do that, I'd have to go out in the morning, come back again, and then go back out in the afternoon and come back again just four times a day just to get my daughter to school and back.
Is your child, though, the only child that would be seeking this run, or do you know of any other parents in a similar position? Now, they might not be living on the island, but would be seeking a bus from that area to the same school.
I was actually talking to another mother there a couple of days ago, and her child also is in Burton Port. And she was told as well that she was would get the transport, but has heard nothing back from it.
Mm. You say in the email to us that your child has autism. Does that mean there'd be requirement for any extra provision on the bus, or is it just the bus seat?
My child is a flight risk. She would not be able to travel alone on the bus, so she would need an escort to come in and get her and bring her out and safely get her to school and back.
Mm. Which it happens all over the county, by the way. It might be very easy for people to call in and say, you know, well, what else do you want? But the truth is that this happens all over the county. And I know of transits that have been put on for one child because they moved to this country and it was done sort of in a day or two. And I'm not trying to pitch any groups against each other. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying I have knowledge of children being accommodated. This is not necessarily unusual. And you're in a position too, is what is the solution? I mean, driving, you would have to take your car clearly on the ferry, drive your child to school, ferry back. I don't know if you'd be able to get the same. You know, what is the solution here for you? What are you going to do?
See, and I also have another child who I have to get to school in the morning. She attends a school on the island.
Uh-huh.
I'd have to get her to school, go out in the morning, and as you said, take my car. But like all that alone, like the ferry costs money.
Of course.
So that's going to be over €70 a week on transfer just for myself to get out. And as you said, I won't be able to make it back in. I'd be sitting in Dunlow for a couple of hours because the next run ends, not for another few hours.
And pardon my ignorance, but I'm just trying to ask questions other might ask. There is no school that your child could attend to on the island or attend on the island?
There is a national school on this island, but because my daughter has autism, the best alternative for her is to get into the autism unit in Dunlow where they can help her out.
And that gives her the best opportunity to maximise her potential. That's what that's all about, and give her the
definitely,
best life.
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Right, we've put it out there. We're going to make our inquiries to Bus Éireann to see what the solution is, what they might come back with us, what they've offered you already. Kind of is insult to injury because it's clear they don't understand the question because they don't really understand the fact that there's an ocean we're talking about here as well. But leave it with us, Gemma, and I'm not sure it will make any difference, but all we can do is inquire and try and help. That's what we're going to do.
That's amazing. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, Gemma. What is it like down at Electric Picnic? We've out and about Scroll Patrol. It's making a return. Shannon Wilkins, good morning to you. How are you getting on, Wilkins?
Hi, Greg. All good. Up, showered, dressed, makeup on, ready to slay the day.
You really are looking different.
Look, I've even got these wee disco-y kind of earrings. So, okay. Yeah.
Right, cool. So we got an awful lot of For Your Page TikToks and what have you saying that don't come here. It's pouring rain. It's a disaster. Are they just like farming or what's the story?
So we left Donegal just after 4 o'clock. Bear in mind, we came in an EV, so we had to do 2 stops for a charger. So we got here around 9:30-ish. You're very far away from where your campsite is. So it took us 35 minutes to walk in, trudging through the rain. You've got all your bags. You're thinking, what do I actually essentially need to bring? Your pajamas and something to keep you dry. I've got my trusty Watson Hire raincoat. Thank you very much.
Fair play to them.
Yeah. So that came in handy yesterday, but unfortunately it did not keep the rain completely at bay.
Now, are you in the tent at the moment? Yeah,
I'm in the tent.
Just give us a look. Right, okay. So there's no one sitting on top of you per se. There's a bit of space there.
This campsite is a wee bit less full. They've said as well that I think it was Janis Joplin was full, so they were sending a few of the excess over here. This is supposed to be the guest campsite. But yeah, the Eru campsite last night looked pretty full as well.
What are your neighbours like? Are they noisy neighbours? That's what bothered me. There's just only 2 bits of cloth between you and those beside you.
We were, you know what? The rain blocked them out. There were a few people having a wee party last night, and this is also near the family campsite. So we did hear a mammy shouting, shut up. at around 3 o'clock.
I wouldn't go there, let alone bring a child. I just don't need the hassle. But this is all about the music too. Now, I know there's an awful lot else going on in Stradbally, but today is the beginning of performances. So what's coming up today? What's the buzz down there?
So funny enough, we actually heard Lewis Capaldi do his sound check this morning. I don't know if it was the real Lewis Capaldi or if it was someone playing instruments and singing like him, but it was beautiful, whoever it was. A big alarm went off this morning as well to wake up all the staff at around 9 o'clock. So I guess that's the way their day starts. I was like, oh my God, is the apocalypse coming? What's going on? We've also got Zara Larsson tonight and Somber. So Somber's had a very big year on TikTok.
I mean, he has produced so much music, hasn't he? I mean, I know Lewis Capaldi's the headliner, but Somber's going to be very popular because people are bombarded with him left, right and centre on the radio.
The radio, and then as well, everyone will actually know the lyrics to his songs, like once you hear him, and he's just kind of got that cool person aesthetic going on, you know. He looks like a real musician, even the way he dresses and he carries himself. He's got that kind of old-fashioned thing we don't see.
Just one question with the lineup in the main stage, and it is all the big hitters, and we'll talk about Saturday and Sunday, but how do you judge then what else to go and see, right? Because there's other stuff happening, there's little cool forest stuff and all that manner of thing, but it feels like if you step away from the main stage, you're going to miss something you don't want to miss. So how do you square that old circle?
So the app, the Electric Picnic app, is very good at keeping you up to date at what you want to do. You can make a wee note of which times things are on so that you're not missing out on something else. For example, I can't remember who we're leaving to go see, but we're leaving the last 20 minutes of someone to go see something else in one of the forests. So even like we're not going to be on the main stage the whole time. Yesterday they had a wee bit of music going on and also live entertainment. So we had fire catchers and things in the Hazelwood Forest. There was a lady singing, she was giving kind of Shania Twain vibes.
Yeah, okay.
So it was good reggae music.
Is everyone behaving themselves? Because, you know, mums and dads, granny and granddads are listening here. Their young ones are down there now. Is everyone behaving themselves?
Well, Greg,
it's early doors.
It's 5 to 11 in the morning.
It's 5 o'clock,
I think,
somewhere.
Come back to me in the early hours of the morning.
I don't think I will. I don't think you'd answer either. Now, the Gorillaz, I would be interested in the Gorillaz, particularly tomorrow. There's an awful lot going on, but they stand out for me. But that's a generational thing, right? So CMAT as well, obviously, is huge. I think last year at Electric Picnic or somewhere, she wore the Daniel O'Donnell dress. But CMAT's going to be huge as well. What's the highlights that I've missed from tomorrow then, Shannon?
Tomorrow, every day is...
You don't have this in your head, do you? You're reading this off your phone.
You're putting me under pressure now. So we have the Mary Walloper, CMAT, the Gorillaz, and actually we have Donegal's own Rian McCauley. He was on whenever Donal was presenting for you. He's actually quite similar, I thought, to Darren Boot. He's got that really nice pub style and the raspiness to his voice.
Yeah.
So I'll definitely be going to see him.
The Undertones, Damien Dempsey, Van Morrison, the Saw Doctors. Like, it really is a big mix of stuff there. And there's band, like, you know, like, go and see Van Morrison, because you don't know how long he's going to be about for. That sounds absolutely horrible, but you know, those are the type of memories that you want to bag. The Saw Doctors may eventually retire. They've been talking about retiring for a long time. So are you looking to see who you really want to see, but also catch some acts that you're getting a rare opportunity to see?
Funny enough, even I was listening to the Crime World podcast last week with Nicola Tallant, and they're having...
not shortlisted for an award, I have to say, but go on.
Not like the great Greg Hughes, no.
Yeah. Go on.
So they are doing a Daniel Kinahan podcast live tonight in one of the tents at 20 past five, so I might try swing by that.
You I know, don't know. What, no harm to Nicola and the team, but I don't know what they're going to do when that story's over. But anyway, keep at it. And Daniel Kinahan is not going to be there. Right. If I wanted to go down and have a pint, how much is a pint? Do we know that yet?
Last night, we got a can of Guinness, €7.
Okay.
What everyone's kind of doing is pre-drinking
of
for
course,
the first
yeah.
time ever as well. We have Guinness on tap. Another cool thing they're doing this year is Diageo are doing the cold can return scheme. So if you go with a cold can, like your Guinness or your Rock Shower, you get cold ones in return. So that would be a good thing for people to look out for, save you trying to cool them down when you're coolers.
All right. And at the moment, yesterday when I said you were you looking forward to it, you were 6-7. What about now? Now that you're there, now that the tent's up, now that it's not as wet as it was last night, how excited are you? Be honest.
Once I heard the music blaring this morning, I was like, okay, it's worth it. Because last night, I have never been as wet in my entire life. I felt like I was in a monsoon. You're cold, then you're in a wee tent. You're like, what is this all for? Why did we come down the road?
Well, enjoy it. We'll chat to you on Monday, get an update. Have a goodie. Look after yourself. Shannon Wilkin there and Donna Marie Doherty's down there as well, but her internet not fantastic. I'm delighted to be getting into my own bed tonight. I don't know about you guys. That's where we leave it. Thank you so much for listening, for watching the show. We're back with you on Monday morning at 9 o'clock.